Please welcome Dr. Richard Casey.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for having me come out tonight. It's always my pleasure to come and speak to groups. I learn a lot from my patients and a lot from these groups. But tonight we're going to talk about clinical trials in prostate cancer, something that I'm sure most of you are aware of, and something that we're seeing more and more of as our knowledge of prostate cancer becomes a bit more broad. Certainly when I started practice about 20 years ago, there wasn't much in the way of treatment for prostate cancer. It was surgery or radiation. Excuse me. And they had introduced a brand new therapy called brachytherapy. This is about 20 years ago. It was going to be the new treatment, and it was going to cure prostate cancer. And it worked for about 3 or 4 years. We abandoned it, and it's back now 20 years later, and brachytherapy has been improved. But every 20 years, there's a new cycle of surgery, radiation, and different treatments. But what we've seen happen in the last 4 to 5 years is, thanks to groups like this as well and activism on our patients' part of view, is that there have been more of an interest in industry in finding therapies for men with prostate cancer for a number of reasons. One is we tend to live a bit longer with our disease, and the way men die from prostate cancer now is much different than the way they died when I started practice. And I know it's horrible to talk about dying, but we've done some good in prostate cancer. Certainly when I started my practice 20 years ago, most men died from blockage of their kidneys with catheters and had a horrible death. Now we do a much better job of controlling local disease, whether it's through radiation or surgery, and men live longer and die from other things. It's still, it's not fun to die from metastatic prostate cancer, but it's certainly we're tending to live a bit longer, and we now have a different challenge. The challenge now is, once we treat the local disease, is how to keep the cancer in check. And the old adage that you die with prostate cancer, not from it, is no longer true. As you know, you do die from prostate cancer and not with it. And hopefully there'll be more advances. So tonight we're going to talk about clinical trials and the implications they have for you as patients, and where they really fit. And I think before we start about talk about some of the trials that we have available to patients now and that will be available in the future, I thought we'd do a little primer on clinical trials. And really talk about what it is, and when you're studying and reading literature, you need to be savvy about what you're reading, because a lot of the stuff we read, certainly on the internet, is bunk. I mean, you can say, I have a website and I take questions from patients, and I get a lot of patients asking me questions, and 95 of the 100 of emails I get a week are, "Doctor, how can I make my penis longer?" But the other 5 are legitimate questions. And you can get some good information on the internet, but you have to be very careful when you read about clinical trial results and about new treatments, because unless you have a good reference, unless it's from a good source, you should remain skeptical. And certainly, when we talk about a clinical trial, we talk about an experiment that's designed to answer a question. And as subjects, as part of a clinical trial, we're guinea pigs in trying to help a physician or a company or a group answer a question. And not all clinical trials are a benefit to patients. You know, we all read about, and those tend to make the press more than the ones that show positive results. We heard about the clinical trial where the young boy was tested for hepatitis vaccination and he died from liver failure. You hear about clinical trials, for example, when surgical new surgeries are tried, when you hear about Siamese twins being separated. That in itself is a clinical trial, because it has to go through certain criteria before doctors can do it. So not all clinical trials are beneficial to patients. They're beneficial to answer the question, but the question might be, does this treatment work? And the answer might be no, and you might be part of that answer. Okay, so clinical trials go through a number of different phases, and it's important that we understand that, because you don't just wake up one day and say, "Eureka, I want to try to see if estramustine works better than stilbestrol." These are drugs that you may or may not know about. But all drug development, including drugs for prostate cancer, have to go through certain phases. And phase one is the most essential part of drug discovery, and it's when a laboratory or a physician has recognized a molecule that he thinks may be beneficial to treat a particular illness. It used to be years ago that doctors would say, well, we have this horrible problem called diabetes. Let's go back to the drawing board and find out how we can cure diabetes, and they look for cures. Now it's the other way around. Now there's so many molecules that the pharmaceutical industry have that they're developing, and they test it, and they say, well, geez, we have a molecule that makes people grow hair. How can we make this a product? Or we have a molecule that kills breast cancer cells. How can we make this into something that we can make money? And then, I mean, they have to make money or else no one would be in business. So the impetus now is from molecule discovery to finding an application rather than going back to the drawing board and saying, how can we cure a particular disease? These drugs are usually treated with tests on animals. And when I did my postdoctoral fellowship in 1982 to 84, I had an animal model which grew breasts in male rats. And believe it or not, there is a problem with young teenage boys when they go through puberty, they develop little breasts. And we developed an animal model, and we grew breasts in these young rats, and then we killed the rats and tested the receptors and the hormone levels of these rats to try to decide if there's a way we could fix it. So most drugs, when they start, are tested on animals. Now, there's a significant problem with testing cosmetics on animals, but I think you'll find that almost all drugs that we see today have at one time spent a time being tested on a rat or a mouse. We don't use large animals. Dog research is much, much less than we used to use, and certainly monkeys and larger animals are not used in most drug trials. But there are specific species of mice that are bred to develop prostate cancers, for example. There's a very well-recognized prostate cancer rat, and it develops prostate cancer, and you treat it, and you know how it works, and after years and years, doctors can determine whether or not the particular rat, the drug that they're testing on the rat, works. So when a molecule is first identified, it's tested on animals, and it's tested just more for toxicity. So does it kill all the animals you give it to? What's the dose range per kilogram of the animal? And they don't really look for the effect of the drug. They really look for safety. You hear on the... And after it goes through rats and we realize it's relatively safe, then human volunteers. And it's not prisoners that take it, it's volunteers. And you often will hear on CFRB, BioVail will advertise for subjects for a weekend in a lab so that university students or anybody who wants to do it who's healthy can volunteer to have injections of the drug and have their blood tested to see what our body does to the drug. So you can't do this on a computer model. There are some things that can be done on a computer, but it takes animals and paid subjects to test whether these drugs are working. And interesting that not all drugs that are started to be tested for one particular application end up that way. For example, sildenafil or Viagra is a prime example. I'm sure you've all heard the sildenafil story that initially it was developed as a blood pressure pill because it inhibits an enzyme in the body that produces vasodilatation or opening of the blood vessels. And researchers thought, this is a great enzyme to inhibit. If we inhibit it, the arteries in the heart will open up, will accept blood, and the heart will work better. So we're going to test this as a blood pressure and a cardioprotective agent. And when they first started doing the early trials, this is phase one and phase two. We'll talk about phase two. They gave paid subjects injections of the drugs, and they measured their blood pressure. And the nurse who did it would come in, she'd give the injection of the drug, and she'd go out to take a recording and come back in, and most of the male patients had rolled over on their stomach. And she was the first one to realize that she was giving the injection of drug to these guys, and they all developed these incredible erections from the drug, and thought that we have enough blood pressure medications around, but we don't have many drugs that improve men's sex life. So it was her observations that took drug from one application to another. And this happens and often, just like drugs for breast cancer that we'll see used in prostate cancer and vice versa, we see this a lot in drug trials. So a phase one drug, and for every 100 drugs that go to phase one will go on to the next step. So the pharmaceutical industry spends a lot of money testing drugs in animals and early in human subjects, only to find that the drug is too toxic, they have to give too much of it, or it causes unwanted side effects, that they abandon it. So only one in 100 really go on to the next level. And the next level is phase two. So we've decided that the drug, may kill prostate cancer in this special rat that develops prostate cancer. Now we want to find out what it does to human volunteers. We've decided it's safe in the early phase one studies. It hasn't killed any of our volunteers. It may have killed a few rats, but we can adjust the dose level appropriately. So we want to see what happens when we give it to humans. And these phase two studies are early studies that often have a placebo. Okay, they don't always have a placebo arm, but we'll talk about that later. But we give it to patients, and we see a lot of phase two studies in prostate cancer drugs because a patient who has metastatic prostate cancer who's quite ill is more likely to volunteer for a drug if he or she has no other options. Now, there are checks and balances we can talk about that prevents the industry from taking advantage of these patients, but the phase two studies are done before we really know if the drug works. We just want to see if we give it to a lot of people, what happens to it, right? And does it have other side effects? Proscar, which is a drug for prostate cancer, for enlarged prostates, was found to grow hair and probably made more money for Merck in growing preventing male pattern baldness than it did from shrinking prostates. Okay, but they look for the particular effect. And these phase two studies will involve tens or up to 100, 150, 200 volunteers. They're not large-scale studies. They're more just to see how the drug works. And there are a lot of prostate cancer drugs. We can talk about it in the second phase. Of phase two, drugs that make it to phase two, probably one in seven then go on to a phase three. So the company has tested on rats. Now they test it on humans. And it may work. For example, we were involved with a drug study, a phase two study on a drug about 5 or 6 years ago that was for prostate cancer for men who have escaped from their hormonal control, and now their PSA was going up despite being on Zoladex or Lupron or whatever drug you use. And we did a study for a pharmaceutical company, which was phase two. Half the men got drug, half the men got placebo. Of those men who got the drug, about three-quarters of them developed these horrible strawberry rashes and really looked quite unusual with it. And so the company abandoned the drug because they realized that we're not going to be able to sell the drug because it causes this horrible rash. But I still have a number of those patients in my practice because despite causing a horrible rash, it had a great effect and it killed the prostate cancer. But again, it may have the effect that you want, but the side effects may be way too much for it to be commercially viable. So if a drug kills cancer, but it kills a third of the people that you give it to, it's not going to be a popular drug for that one person it kills. It may be very popular for the two people who survive it. So these things are all done. And these tests are usually done in communities or at universities. So these type of phase two studies are studies that we have out here. Now, once we've decided the drug has an effect in animals, that it's not dangerous, that it appears to be effective in men or patients, or men or women, then it's time to do what's called a phase three study. And a phase three study is really the study that costs the company the $100 million because they need to do thousands of patients and they need to compare it to either existing therapy or placebo. And no one likes being in the placebo part of a study. They say you can get a sugar pill or you'll get the real drug and you won't know. But you need to do this to see if a drug works because we all have stories where someone took this green tea and it worked great, their PSA went to zero, or they changed their diet, and there are unusual reactions that happen in people, and you really need to have a group of people who are on placebo to test if the drug works better than the natural history of the disease. Because as we know, with particularly prostate cancer, you may think your PSA is doubling, and then one day you wake up and it's not anymore. It's sort of started to go down on its own, or it's going up a lot slower. So placebos are a necessary evil of phase three. And these phase three studies are done all across Canada, and we have a number of those that we would talk about. Now, what protects patients from the drug industry? Well, there are recognized standards that are worldwide that have been agreed to ensure that patients aren't taken advantage of. Because certainly those patients who have prostate cancer who are not doing well with treatment say, well, look, I'll try anything. Well, we don't want patients to try anything because it's unfair advantage because an unscrupulous pharmaceutical company might say, well, we're going to try this drug that we don't know if it works, we don't know if it's going to kill them or not, but they're desperate. That just doesn't happen. There are protections placed. There are local standards, and there are ethics committees. These are committees of people that look after the benefit of the patient, and they're your They're your protectors, and they're made up of community people. Most ethics committees require that a local lawyer that has nothing to do with the drug company or nothing to do with the physician that's running the trial, that there's a person of color, that there's an Aboriginal person, that there's a pharmacist on it, and a number of people that represent the people that they're testing. So they look at these trials and decide whether they're appropriate. You might say, well, what does a person of color or an Aboriginal who doesn't work in the business know about clinical trials? Well, they learn being on the committee, but they also know what makes sense, and they give their insight into the cultural importance of the trial. And, for example, how difficult it is to do a clinical trial on someone who might have Alzheimer's disease, because this person may not be able to give a consent to give the trial, so you need to get their family involved. So it's very important that you're protected before you go into a clinical trial to ensure that your rights are managed, and that if any time throughout the clinical trial you have a question, you have someone to ask who isn't the physician testing you. Because let's face it, we have a conflict of interest. If I'm involved in a clinical trial by a pharmaceutical company and you have a problem, I may not be the most objective person to talk about it. You might say, well, I like the drug, but I don't want to make my doctor angry. I want to stop taking the drug. I need to get some more information, and you need to have someone. So these committees, universities have ethics committees, community hospitals have ethics committees, and these committees are very important to protect you. There's also something called informed consent. And before you sign any of these consents, it's the physician's responsibility to make sure you understand what you're signing. Now, these are not contracts. So you can decide to be in a clinical trial at 5 o'clock, and at 5:05 you can say, I've changed my mind, I withdraw my consent. So anytime you're in a clinical trial, you can just say, I withdraw my consent, and it's over. Your treatment should, the new drug will end. The physician should still treat you as your patient, and you're under no obligation. So it's a one-sided agreement. The physician agrees to keep you informed, and you decide whether or not you want to continue on in the trial. Okay. Even though if all the physicians that do clinical trials have a contract with the company or the sponsor, the person who's paying the bills, his responsibility really should be to you. So he may get $1,000 per patient to put you in a clinical trial, and that should pay his overhead and for his nurses and for the drugs, but his responsibility should always be to you. And there are stories about unethical physicians who have fabricated patients to make money, or who twist patients' arms to get them involved in clinical trials. But really, that's why ethics committees are involved and informed consent, and why everything should be transparent. So that happens less and less, and certainly in North America, it is not a common occurrence. Okay. So and also the physician should not involve you in clinical trials where they think you should be at risk. And we can talk about that as we get into the trial. So let's talk about some of the language of clinical trials. And it's important that you know the language, because you're going to read about clinical trial reports that may interest you. You read something in literature that says there's a new drug that cures prostate cancer. Well, you need to know how this drug was tested. Was it tested on 3 people? Was it tested on 3,000 people? And it's very important to know this. And The trials that are important for us to know are called prospective trials. And these are trials that are done starting today in the future, as opposed to retrospective trials. You'll read that a retrospective study showed that a diet high in animal fat suggests that you have a higher incidence of prostate cancer. And what these studies are, they're chart reviews. So they'll go back and they'll say, let's look at all the people in Brampton that had prostate cancer and look at their diet and see how many of these patients ate red meat 3 times a day. And someone might draw a conclusion, well, since all these people who had prostate cancer ate red meat 3 times a day, then red meat's bad for prostate cancer. Well, the problem with that type of a conclusion is, I mean, everybody eats meat in this part of most everybody eats meat in this part of the country. There's no control group. In other words, you can't compare it to a group that ate vegetables 3 times a day to find out what their cancer incidence is. And it's retrospective. You're looking backwards. And medical care changes from year to year. So just like it took us a while to realize that our treatment for prostate cancer was actually making a difference, you can't look back and make many very good decisions on what you can do now. Having said that, most of the nutritional work, most of the nutritional studies that you read is based on retrospective data. They look at Japanese men and their diet and what their incidence of prostate cancer is. They look at men from Sweden. And you can often find interesting facts from this, but it doesn't have the same science as something as prospective. So if you wanted to find out if red meat caused prostate cancer, you would take healthy men in their 50s, and you'd feed half of them red meat, and you'd feed the other half a red meat substitute. You wouldn't tell which group has the meat. You'd try to disguise it so both men thought they were eating the same food. You wouldn't tell the doctor, and you'd look 15 years in the future, and you'd say, okay, which group of men had prostate cancer? And it's very difficult to do. So sometimes it's not that easy to answer these questions. So be very careful when you read studies that say, we looked at what happened over the last 15 years, and we've decided that a diet rich in vitamin E prevents prostate cancer. That may well be the case, but you have to be skeptical when you look back on retrospective data. But lots of times, that's how we find the questions to ask in the future. And that's why these nutritional studies look back and say, well, it looks as though men who have a vitamin E-rich diet have a low incidence of prostate cancer based on retrospective data. Now we're going to do a study and look in the future. So while it's not as good science as a prospective study, it gives us the questions to ask in a prospective manner. Okay. In other words, you want to see when you read a study is randomized. Okay. And these are studies where patients are selected on a randomized fashion to be in the study. Okay. It's very difficult to do this because as a patient, you don't want to be randomized. You like to have some input into where you're being treated. And for most studies to have some scientific merit, the physician can't say, you know, I know you have prostate cancer and I really want you to be on this new drug, so I'm going to put you on the treatment arm of the drug. And the next person who comes in who isn't as bad as you, I'm going to put on the placebo arm of the drug. Because what's going to happen is over the course of you doing the trial, all the sick people are going to get the drug and the less sick people are going to get the placebo, and you're not going to get the true drug effect. So you need to be able to take the selection bias away from the investigator and the selection bias away from you. As patients, you might say, well, you know, I'll go in the study, but I want to be certain I get drug. Well, I'm sorry, then you can't be in the study because we need to have a random selection between patients that are motivated, that aren't motivated, patients that will comply and meet the study schedule as opposed to patients who won't meet the study schedules, patients who will drop out, patients who eat and drink too much. We need to have an equal representation, and the only way to do that is that the study is randomized. So if you look at studies when you read on the Internet about a drug that has an effect on a cancer, you need to see that word randomized, because if it isn't, then there is a bias in the study that may or may not negate the effect of the drug or make the drug look better than it is. Okay, and this is what is the what burns patients the most when they get involved in clinical trials, because the investigator will say, we have this great drug, but there's a 50% chance you're going to get placebo. And what happens is the patient gets involved in the drug study, knows he's getting placebo, and drops out of the study. So it becomes very, very difficult to have patients stay in these studies knowing that they're going to get placebo. And there's a question about whether or not placebo study should be done in patients with cancer. And often, and there was just a study on breast cancer that was stopped because the investigators saw that the effect was so good for treatment of breast cancer that they stopped the study and they said, we're no longer going to, it's unethical to give people placebo because we now know this drug works. And so all these studies that we see are monitored by the company, and as soon as the effect is obvious, they'll stop it and say, okay, we're going to stop putting people on the sugar pill because we know the drug works, and we'll offer the drug to everybody who wants it. So randomized and double-blind. Double-blind means that neither you as the patient or the doctor knows who's getting the drug. And this is important because if I know that you're getting the drug, I may treat you differently than I know you're getting a sugar pill. For example, if I knew you were getting a drug and you came in with a swollen ankle, you say, Doc, I think this is from the drug. If I knew you were getting placebo, I'd say, well, I don't think it's from the drug. I'm not going to record it as a side effect. And it's probably because you sat around too long. But if I know you have the drug, I'm more likely to report it as a side effect. So it's important that the physician not know. Although most of the time you can guess on if you have a bad illness and you're on a drug. For example, when we did the Viagra studies, patients knew they were getting the drug because for 3 years they were unable to get an erection, and now all of a sudden you give them Viagra and things are perking up. They knew they were getting the drug. Although even in those patients, a third of them had a placebo response. So patients will respond to placebo, and even in cancer studies, patients who are struggling with cancer, who you give a placebo to or a sugar pill, will sometimes get better on the placebo. And we'd say the best drug to sell for any illness is a placebo, because the 30% of people get better no matter what the illness is. Arthritis, high blood pressure, cancer, erectile dysfunction, about 30% of patients tend to get better in most instances. We don't understand why there's a placebo response, but we all know what a positive attitude does for your illness. I don't think a positive attitude will change your PSA that much, but we all know that PSAs can change like the wind, and placebos will change them as well. So we need to make sure that the physician doesn't know you're on drug, or you don't know you're on drug either. But there are protections built in. If you're taking a drug, and say for prostate cancer, and you have a heart attack and you have to go to the emergency room, and the emergency doctor says, look, I need to know what this new drug is, because it might be what's responsible for your heart attack, or it might be thinning your blood, there are ways that he can pick up a phone and find out if you're on the drug. You'll be out of the clinical trial, but if he feels that it's safe for you to know that you're no longer on the drug, he can find out easily enough. And that's where the ethics committee comes in, and your investigator will be available. So if it's unsafe, you know. If you're away on vacation and you get a complication you think might be related to the drug, physicians can always find out whether or not you're taking the medication. So it's a double blind, but it's not written in stone, and it's important that you know that. Okay, and as I said earlier, you need to have a placebo-controlled study. And while studies can be done without placebos, and certainly in earlier studies for when we were trying to measure the effect of a drug, particularly prostate cancer, not all the drug studies have a placebo, because if your PSA is doubling every 3 months and you have bone pain and you're getting sick, if we think the drug works, often the number of placebo, the percentage of placebo will be much less than 50-50, or you may be involved in studies where there is no placebo. Most studies, to make a scientific statement and to show that it's better than nothing, need to have a placebo arm eventually. Okay. So let's talk a little bit of any questions about clinical trials up to now? No? Well, I'm glad you all know about trials. Yes?
Is a placebo stops growing the cancer that the
has? What I said, when you have clinical trials where they have a placebo, and placebo is an inactive substance, in other words, the drug, you're getting an infusion of a drug that's supposed to kill prostate cancer. So in a placebo-controlled study, you'll get an infusion of sugar water. Okay? In some instances, that infusion of sugar water will be as effective as the drug. We don't understand why. So about a third of patients, and depending on the illness, will have a response to nothing. And that speaks not only to the way patients react to positive feedback, but how little we understand about disease as well. Yeah,
but it also lowers the PSA?
PSA can be lowered by placebo, definitely.
And how much it can go down?
Well, it could go to zero.
Cancer
is still there, but for some reason the PSA has gone down. We all have, I'm sure there's people here that have had their PSA going along, and all of a sudden the PSA will drop for no reason at all. You have not done anything. Maybe it's something you ate the day before. And in these clinical trials, we don't control what you eat or how you think. And sometimes a positive attitude may reduce your PSA. Again, we don't understand. And the endpoints we use for disease are endpoints that, in other words, what we measure for disease are things that we think make a difference. But it may not be PSA that matters. It may be other things that are going on that we don't understand. But to answer your question, placebo can have the same effect as a drug. Now, what we know is that over the course of time, the placebo effect will go away. In other words, when we first, to use an example, and back to Viagra again, when we started the Viagra trials, about a third of men who we first gave the pill to and said, this is a drug that may improve your erections, came back and said, it's great. This drug is working. We knew they were, we didn't know they were on placebo, but half of them were on placebo. Over the course of 2 to 3 months of taking the drug, when their excitement wears out and they get back to the same routine they were in before they started the drug, the placebo effect goes away. So the way we tell the difference between a placebo effect and a drug effect, is that a placebo effect is usually short-lived, 1 or 2 months. So this patient who has a PSA will go down initially, who's on placebo, the PSA will go back up and start to climb again, as opposed to a drug effect, and that's how we tell whether the placebo will go down and will stay down.
And what is the side effect on that?
Well, it's funny. Placebo side effects can be the same as drug side effects. In clinical trials, we'll often see a patient taking a sugar pill will complain of horrible headaches. Ever since I've started this drug, the headaches are horrible, and I've read that this could potentially be a side effect of the drug. It's amazing the power of suggestion. Or I've gained weight, or whatever, or I've had a rash. And in all, if you look at when you go to the pharmacy, they give you the printout of what the potential side effects for drugs. All you see are side effects that were greater than placebo. But trust me, patients who took placebo grew hair. Patients who took placebo could not sleep. It's the power of suggestion. So you get the same side effect profile in placebos as you get in the real drug.
So it's similar to the hormone.
Yeah. So you could take a placebo, and we did a study with a placebo injection, and men who took the placebo injections developed breast tenderness, their libido went down, they lost their erections, even though they were getting nothing. Okay. And then I think that's why some men will improve on placebo, because you say, here's a drug, this may stop your PSA, it may make you feel better, and that positive energy. I'm not a very touchy-feely doctor. I believe in science, but some patients will get better with the power of suggestion. So there's no doubt that placebos may be beneficial, but usually it's just for a short period of time. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
You pick your volunteers, and are they counseled if they're doing it just for the money or for wrong reasons?
That's a very good question. So how do you pick your volunteers? First of all, you're not allowed to pay patients to be in clinical trials. What you can pay is parking. Or maybe if you're going to ask the patient to be there all day, you can give them a coffee and a donut and maybe pay for a sandwich. But for these types of trials, you should not be paid, because that will bias the type of person that will come into the trial. Now, that's in Canada. In the United States, there are some trials where patients are paid. Patients are paid to donate blood in the United States. And in the United States, a lot of patients get involved in clinical trials because they don't have health care. So there's an inherent bias in a healthcare environment like the United States, where patients with prostate cancer who don't have insurance, they look for clinical trials because they know if they're going to get their MRI, their CAT scan, and it's all covered by the company. But in Canada, we're not allowed to pay patients. They cannot receive any benefit other than the drug. If there's one benefit patients tend to perceive they receive from being involved in clinical trials, is a little more attention from their doctor, because the doctor has to do more testing and has to see the patient more often. How do we pick patients? We generally don't advertise for patients for clinical trials because we don't need to, because, as you know, your urologist is busy enough. Thank you very much. But for some of the more unusual drugs, we tend to network with other doctors. So I might call Stan Flax and say, Stan, I got this new drug. Do you have any patients that have, you know, a right foot bigger than their left foot? I need volunteers. So we will occasionally ask other doctors to give us leads and have that doctor approach you before we reapproach the doctor. But most of the patients come out of our practice, or they hear about it at a venue like this, about a new drug, or they'll read about it on the newspaper. Patients have to meet certain criteria, and it is tougher to get into a clinical trial than it is to get into the Granite Club. I mean, it is very difficult. You have to meet very stringent entry criteria, and if you don't meet the entry criteria, even though it may be the perfect drug for you, if you're too heavy, for example, or you've had hormone therapy 1 month too long, you're out of it. Because we try to make the patients that are in clinical trials as uniform as possible, so you can't say, well, that was great, but half your patients had hormones for 6 months, the other half had it for 3 months. How do we know it wasn't the hormones and not the new drug? So we usually get them out of our own practice. And not all urologists, not all physicians get involved in clinical trials, because you need to have a nurse, but we all know about the clinical trials. And those of you that have gone to Princess Margaret when your doctor sent you there for radiation probably were approached by one of the radiation oncologists saying, you know, we have a new trial going on where we're comparing radiation to 30 days of radiation compared to 20 days of radiation. So each center has their particular interest in clinical trials. I happen to have an interest in clinical trials that I've had for 15 years, and Dr. Flax in town here has now started doing clinical trials, and most larger communities have one or two physicians that are interested, and the reason this has happened, it's left the university center, because rather than have the patient travel to, imagine having to travel to Sunnybrook twice a week for 8 weeks in traffic, and then wait for your doctor for an hour or two And I'm not taking anything. Sunnybrook's a great facility, but you do tend to wait a bit there. It might be more advantage to have the clinical trial locally so you can go to your local doctor who tells your general practitioner who knows you. So clinical trials have now come into the community and are better for patients. Okay. Any other questions about... Did that answer your question about... Okay.
Dr. Casey, when a trial is done from the United States when it comes to Canada, is it fast-track compared to one that originates in Canada?
No, that's a very good question. First of all, there are not many trials that come to Canada from the United States that aren't involved with the sister company in Canada. For example, most pharmaceutical or biotech companies have representatives in Canada or work through licensing arrangements in Canada. So a small biotech company may have a drug for prostate cancer, and they'll approach Abbott Pharmaceuticals and say, could you help us with this trial? But let's say there's a small group in the United States that are having difficulty getting American subjects. And that's the only reason they'd come. Well, there's two reasons they'd come to Canada. One is they're either having difficulty getting subjects in the United States because it's either a very unusual drug or there's lots of trials going on, or two, it's cheaper to do it in Canada. And it is cheaper for them to do research in Canada because it's 30 cents on the dollar. So this Free Trade Act has started to bring American companies coming up to Canada to look for Canadian subjects because it's cheaper and because we provide better material. Now, I don't like to think of our patients as material, but think about the Canadian healthcare system. You all have doctors. You all have family doctors. You've been to a urologist, and you can go back to the same urologist, and it doesn't cost you a penny to see him, generally. Whereas opposed in the United States, where not everybody has family doctors, people go directly to specialists, and they tend to shop around. So from a scientific point of view, we have a more homogeneous population in Canada, and it's very attractive to American companies to come to Canada and say, you know, we want to do trials here. Now, you have to file with Health Protection Branch to do trials in Canada, and there are certain... So if a company, American company, has this new drug that for erections, they come to Canada, and they got to go through our Health Protection Branch and file all the information with Health Protection, and our government has to be happy that this is a reasonable question, that the drug is reasonable, and it has all the safety side effects. It still has to go through a local ethics committee, and it still has to go through local physicians. So it's very difficult to fast-track it. More importantly, you cannot pay physicians more to work faster. So they can't say, well, we're paying American doctors $1,000 a patient. If we go to Canada, we pay them $2,000 Canadian, they'll work quicker. So to answer your question, generally they're not fast-tracked. But what they do, and I've seen fast-track in trials before, is they'll say, we think this is a great drug. We're going to do it in Canada and the United States and increase our number of patients. Generally, though, in the clinical trial community, Canada is not considered part of the United States. It's considered part of Europe. So when I go to meetings in clinical trials that are being done, we're generally grouped with the Europeans and not with the Americans. The Mexicans are grouped outside the Americans as well. But the FDA will accept Canadian patients as part of their registration. So they look at the Canadians as being as the same as Americans, but the companies look at it as being different. Does that answer your question? That they're not going to come here and do work that they can't do in the United States.
Can you be on more than one trial at a time? Or is it advisable to inform the other trial that you've been approached to go on another trial?
Yeah, you really can't be on more than one trial at a time. It depends, but again, it will depend on the trial. If you're on an observational trial that is looking at, say you're registered because it's a diet-related trial where you're not altering your diet, you're just giving them information about your background and about your diet, then it may be possible to be in another trial. But generally, you cannot be in more than one trial, and you have to tell your doctor if you are, and if you've been approached by a physician to enter a trial, and you tell him you're already in a clinical trial, it's his obligation to say, I'm sorry, you cannot be in this trial. That should be his answer. His answer shouldn't be, go back and tell your other doctor and drop out of that trial and come into this trial. You know, he should really defer to your present experience. In clinical trials, if you've been on one trial for prostate cancer, usually you cannot go in another trial with prostate cancer unless you receive placebo. In other words, you don't want to muddy the waters if you've been treated by an investigational drug and it didn't work, so I'm going to try another investigational drug to see if that works, because then you're not a typical patient, because there may be some effect from the first drug that you don't know. But if you've received placebo, then often you can, or if there's been a long length of time in between the two drugs, sometimes you can. But usually you get one kick at the can, one trial. Okay. So any other questions about that?
Doctor, individuals being what they are, it's quite possible that a particular drug affects one person differently to another. I mean, how can you compensate for that?
That's a very good question, and that's why the question is, you know, how do you know that the effect isn't just due to the person and not the drug? That's why when you go to phase three, when you're actually looking for the effect of the drug, first of all, you need thousands of patients, and you try to pick these patients as being as much alike as you can. So when they analyze clinical trials, they look at age, weight, racial characteristics and background, because it's important, because Asians may respond differently than Swedes or other racial groups. So you can't be certain. And there are some patients who will have no response to a drug, and we don't know why. But that's the reason we randomized the trial, that's the reason we use placebo, and that's why we look at thousands of patients to try and answer that. But we've all had patients who don't respond to a drug, and we can't figure out why. So let's talk about some trials that are involved, that are ongoing around here in Canada, in Ontario, that may be of some interest to you. And then maybe if any of you have been involved in these trials, I'd like you to speak up and give me your input into what you think about it. Yes.
They asked me to join this study group down at Sunnybrook Hospital. Mm-hmm. And after a consultation with my family and with another person about it, I decided to go that route. It was involved in inserting some seeds into me, and I have to report there every 3 months and then on a 6 months basis for 2 years, and then carry on a, I think it's a yearly base after that. And
these are radioactive seeds?
Yeah. And I have no side effects. They say this steps up the process better than the long-term treatment of 37 treatments or so.
So you had external beam and seeds, or just seeds?
Yeah.
Both together?
Yeah.
And when you were approached for the trial, is there a group of men in the trial who don't receive any treatment?
That I don't know. No. This was a confidential between the doctor and myself, and therefore I spoke to other persons in that group they were in, and they sort of said yes and no kind of thing.
And you signed a consent?
Yeah.
And you felt
Right.
And no pressure from your doctor to drink?
No, and they said, like you mentioned earlier, that I could leave any time I wanted to. Just inform them that I no longer wish to participate.
Did you return? Did you have to return the seeds after you leave?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I...
Well, I tell you, this is a bit of a... they used to say about the family jewels, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I said, now they're worth a dollar or two.
Well, that's good. And clinical trials don't always involve drugs, and like you said, they may involve radioactive implants, they may involve surgical procedures, or they may involve hypnosis or psychotherapy. So you do a clinical trial to answer any question. So to answer the question whether seeds with or without external beam radiation is better than seeds alone or radiation load, you can have that. But you demonstrate not one of the problems of the trial, but once the seeds are in, they're yours. And so if it turns out the trial is not working or has made you worse, you have to live with the consequences of that. I'm not saying that this is a bad trial. I'm saying that sometimes that will happen. You want to give them the...
I actually mentioned this to them. I said, what happens to the seeds after a period of time? They said sometimes they move around.
Mm-hmm.
They'll move from the area, and they'll probably find them in the leg or in another part of the body.
They can be in your lung.
There'll be no ill effect from them.
That's good. Well, good. Yeah. And it's nice when clinical trials work out, don't cause problems, at least.
Well, as I say, I've had no side effects as such. I function normally pretty well.
Well, good.
So I feel quite...
But good. There was no placebo, so there wasn't a time when they could give you seeds that were not radioactive.
No, well, I've been on this now, as I say, about 18 months, so I can't complain too bad.
Good. Well, that's good. And maybe we'll talk about that, because there is a trial going on. So let's talk about some trials. And when you look at disease, trials come at different parts in disease. Not all clinical trials are offered to you when you're on death's doorstep, because that's really when it's too late. There are two trials, and there are probably more that are ongoing now in the area. One's called the SELECT. One thing about clinical trials, to make them attractive or to talk about them, they all have acronyms. So SELECT has something to do with selenium and lycopenes. I don't know exactly what each word, but and this is a trial that's originating at from Sunnybrook Hospital. Anybody on the SELECT trial? It's a trial where men who have had biopsies of their prostate gland and found to have an abnormality that's not quite cancer, and the abnormality is called PIN. I'm sure you've heard about prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia or high-grade PIN. And just like women who have pap smears and who have abnormal pap smears, and a certain percentage will go on to have cervical cancer, there is a condition in prostate that certain men, when discovered, will go on to have prostate cancer. And this is called PIN. Again, another acronym for prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia. And Neil Fleshner, who's the principal investigator, and the principal investigator is the guy who's responsible for the trial. He's done it at Sunnybrook and a number of places across Ontario doing it. I know there's a, I think it's being done in Brampton. There's also one in Burlington that are doing it. And it's a trial where men who have this condition are randomized to a nutritional supplement or nothing to see if this nutritional supplement will reduce the chance of him going on to have prostate cancer. And we know through retrospective data, through data that I said earlier, where we look at men who had PIN, we'd say, geez, you know, about 50% of men who have PIN turn out to have prostate cancer. And we know that through retrospective data, and we also know it through studies that have followed these men. Can we give them something to reduce the risk of them going on to have cancer? And this is one study to try to answer that question. Because right now, the standard of care, and the standard of care is a term that you should know, means what you're offered now, what's accepted in the medical condition. If you have a condition called PIN, your doctor says, I'll see you back in 6 months for another biopsy. There's nothing he can give you at the present time that's proven to reduce your risk of having prostate cancer. So here is a study where it's ethical to give a placebo because that's the standard of care. The standard of care is no treatment. So they're comparing no treatment to a nutritional supplement and looking at the incidence of prostate cancer in this group of patients. And they need to get hundreds of patients to show that this is significant. It may not turn out to be useful, and the downside for patients who are taking this nutritional supplement is they take a few extra calories each day, and they're taking some vitamin E and some selenium and some lycopenes. So there's very little downside. So this is an example of a study where the placebo arm is what you'd get anyway, where it's a win-win for the patient, and there's really no downside for the physician or the patient. And this is a good study that's going to answer a very important question, or it may not answer the question because it may turn out we can't get enough patients. And this has been recruiting. The next, yes?
Is there a study being operated at the present time on the PSA readings being downgraded from what we call, might say, a safe 4 down to a lower number? And through one of these study groups, for instance?
Yeah, there is. I'll get to that, okay? And most of these studies use PSA, but in the SELECT study, PSA is useful, but as you know, it's not that useful. And we don't, for this disease called PIN, we can't rely on PSA as being the best way to tell. And all these patients need another biopsy. REDUCE is another study. And those of you who may have read the newspaper, that there is some evidence that some of the drugs we've been using for prostate cancer shrinkage, such as Proscar, actually have an impact on prostate cancer developing in men. And there's a large study just published that showed that about a quarter of men who took Proscar, that there was 25% less cancer in a group of men who took Proscar than men who didn't take Proscar. And Proscar is a prostate shrinker that we use for benign enlargement. So GlaxoSmithKline has a drug that is very similar to Proscar. They think it might be better, that they think may reduce the risk of prostate cancer. And they're doing a large study all across Canada where they take patients who have had a negative biopsy. In other words, you go to your doctor, your PSA is slightly elevated. Your doctor does a biopsy and says, geez, you don't have cancer, but your PSA is a bit elevated, so you may be at risk of developing cancer. Would you like to join a study group where we give you a drug compared to placebo and see what the risk of you getting prostate cancer. Okay. Now again, the standard of care right now is that if you have an elevated PSA and a negative biopsy, the standard of care is that you'd be watched and have no treatment other than some nutritional guidance. This study is comparing the standard of care to a possibly a new drug that may shrink your prostate gland and may reduce your risk of prostate cancer. Very attractive to a guy who has a PSA of 6.5, a brother that may have prostate cancer, and a bunch of friends that he golfs with that have been to see Dr. Flax and had their prostate removed. So it's attractive in trying to reduce your risk. The downside to a study like this is that this prostate shrinker may have some ill effects. And the major ill effect of a prostate shrinker is that it, in about 1 in 100 guys, it may reduce your sex drive. It may cause some erectile dysfunction. And it may grow some unwanted hair on your head. But I don't know many guys who call hair on their head unwanted. Okay. And this study is going on throughout Ontario and is just starting. It's started in the summer. And they'll need a couple, probably 500 or 600 patients. These patients are being approached by the urologist after they have a negative biopsy. This is in a very exciting area of prostate cancer, because while we're all here on a support group because many of us have cancer already, wouldn't it be nice to be able to prevent cancer from happening? And it looks as though there are going to be a number of agents, including nutritional advice, that will reduce your risk of having cancer. And so the guy whose father had cancer and his brother had cancer will be able to take an agent and reduce his likelihood of having prostate cancer. And this is a very exciting field. I'm going to see more and more of activity in this area, partly because there are tens of thousands of men who would benefit from a drug like this, as opposed to the hundreds of men who might benefit from the cancer drugs that are given when, by the time your PSA is rising and you've had hormonal therapy. So those are two ongoing studies that are going around here. Okay, and just to renew, that the SELECT study is the PIN patients, and that's still looking for patients. So if you have friends that are concerned about it and they mention PIN to you, speak to your urologist. He'll probably know where it is. And if he doesn't, you know, you can drop me a line on my website, which they'll give you my email later, and I can direct you to a urologist closest to you that's doing it. And the REDUCE study, as I said earlier, is an attempt to try and reduce the risk of you getting prostate cancer. There's going to be a lot of stuff in the newspaper about these types of drugs, partly because it's expensive. You can imagine that while there may be a 25% reduction in prostate cancer, what we don't know, and is a suggestion that those that do develop cancer on the drug may develop a worse kind of cancer, and so we may be helping 25% of men while we're doing some harm to another 20%. So this is very preliminary, and it will take 10 years before we really know if we've done good for the whole group of patients and whether it's worth the cost. As you can imagine, that this is expensive. You have to take a drug that costs you $2 a day for the rest of your life. The healthcare system better be sure that it's going to make a difference and reduce prostate cancer death. Okay, so what about people who now have the diagnosis of prostate cancer? And to answer the gentleman's question about, it doesn't really answer your question. There's a drug called SPIRIT. Anybody on the SPIRIT trial here? And the SPIRIT trial is a trial that's trying to answer the question, is brachytherapy, which are the radioactive implants, better or as good as radical prostatectomy for men who have early-stage disease? I'm a surgeon. I'm biased. I think surgery is better than radiation. I'm a radiation oncologist. I'm biased. I think radiation is better than surgery. So, and if you go to two or three different physicians, I'm sure you've all had different opinions. So we're not certain whether or not brachytherapy is as good as surgery. And surgery, we like to think, is the gold standard for men 65 or younger with localized disease. This is a study being done throughout Canada. A very difficult study where patients who have early stage disease are randomized to either brachytherapy or surgery. The difficulty with this trial, as you can imagine, is by the time your doctor's told you have prostate cancer and you've done your research, you have an idea of what you want. I think I want to have surgery. A friend of mine had surgery. Or I might want to have brachytherapy. That decision is taken out of your hands if you participate. There's a coin toss. Heads, you get radical prostatectomy. Tails, you get brachytherapy. So it's very, very difficult to convince patients to take the decision out of their hands, because very few physicians are so uncertain about this treatment that they don't have a personal view. So if you ask your doctor, what would you do if you were me? Most doctors would say, well, I'd have brachytherapy or I'd have radical prostatectomy. Not many would say, well, I'd toss a coin and whatever the coin said, I'd go for. But this is a very important trial that we need patients for, because unless we study this, we're never going to know whether brachytherapy is as good or better than radical prostatectomy. And it's sad to say that what drives a lot of these treatments that you have are the finances of the treatment as well. In the United States, physicians are paid very well for brachytherapy. You know, I see patients in the United States who are pushed into brachytherapy because their physician is reimbursed very good for it and felt that that was the safest treatment for them, where that same patient may be told in Canada that, a radical prostatectomy is more appropriate. So this is a very, very forward-thinking trial, very difficult to recruit patients for. And what they've done is they've picked certain surgeons who can do the surgery. So while your physician may be involved in the trial, unless he's qualified in to do the surgery, he'll have to send you to another urologist. And the way you get qualified is you have to submit 20 or 30 of your previous radical prostatectomies for review. They got to make sure that your pathology was good, you did it for the right reasons. So it involves some peer review. And as you know, doctors don't like other doctors looking over their shoulders. But it's a good way to bring the whole community together to answer a question. And this question is not going to be answered for 15 years, but it's a very forward-thinking trial. We don't see many trials like this. Having said that, if you're in the SPIRIT trial and you decide you want to be in the trial and they toss a coin and you get radical surgery and you don't want radical surgery, you can drop out of the trial before you have the surgery. So no one's going to grab you and say, sorry, you picked heads, you got to have the surgery. But what your physician would do here is say, look, if you're going to change your mind, we'd rather you not get involved in the trial because it's going to bias our results. Be certain you want to go with whatever the answer is. And so we counsel patients to be very certain that they want to be part of this scientific endeavor. The upside for the patients, other than participating in a clinical trial and contributing to the knowledge of prostate cancer, the upside might be that they might get referred to a surgeon who has more experience, but most surgeons are very good at doing this. But there's no other upside. You can't go to a trial where your doctor says, you know, if you participate in the SPIRIT trial, you'll get radiation next week. But if you don't participate, it's going to take you 3 months. That's unethical. That puts undue pressure on the patient. So you don't get any better treatment in the SPIRIT trial than you'd get if you weren't in the trial. But you contribute to the science of prostate cancer. Okay, there's another study going on that is trying to address, is there something we can do for patients before we take out the prostate to make the results of surgery better? As you know, those of you that had radical surgery were told by your doctor that it doesn't always remove the cancer, and that there's a 20 to 30% risk that even though the cancer is being removed, it might come back. Your PSA may come back. Now, sometimes PSA comes back, and it's not the cancer. It's just that there's some tissue that's causing PSA to be produced, or that the cancer isn't growing, but it's a real problem. That's one problem. The other problem is that there's a wait to have your prostate cancer removed. In the United States, you see your doctor on Monday. He tells you you need a radical prostatectomy on Tuesday, and it's out on Friday. Whereas in Canada, if that was the case, you'd wake up on Saturday and realize it was a dream, and you're waiting 3 more months. Most surgeons take 6 or 8 weeks before they get you into hospital, and it's that anxiety around waiting. And there are some studies that suggest, and Robert Nam from Sunnybrook Hospital, I think, looked at this, and suggest that a reasonable waiting time is 3 months or 4 months, but if you're waiting much longer than that to get your treatment, and many of you wait that long to get your radiation therapy, then you know, you're sitting on a hot potato, and it's not conducive to relaxing time at home. You want to do something. So at least is it possible that we give you something to treat your prostate while you're waiting for surgery? And there are a lot of other diseases where you would treat it before you would remove it. Breast cancer. Sometimes you can shrink it before you take it out or radiate it. In prostates, there are a number of prostate shrinkers. And there was a huge trial that went on with the LHRH agonist. That was Lupron or Zoladex or Superfact, where this is about 3 or 4 years ago, where we took patients and we treated some patients for 3 months and some patients for 8 months. Anybody involved in that trial, the 3 versus 8? No? And then we took out their prostate. And initially we said, this is great because the men who had 8 months of treatment, their margins, they didn't have as much cancer outside the prostate, and their cancer looked a lot better, and maybe this is great. And then we realized that 2-3 years later, their PSA still came back as much as the people who didn't have treatment. Their prognosis was no better, and it was an optical illusion. We made the prostate look different for the pathologist, who said, this looks a lot better, but who cares what it looks like? It's how the cancer acts that matters. There are drugs that are, and taking 8 months of an LHRH or Zoladex is not without potential side effects, as you know. There are some newer drugs now, much like the prostate shrinkers, that are being tested in this population of men who are going to have surgery. We think maybe we can eliminate surgery in 20% of these patients, and those patients who we eliminate surgery may live without any recurrence. And if that's the case, then maybe we can say we'll use this drug on everybody. So right now we're involved. I'm involved in this trial as well, where patients who've decided to have radical surgery will be randomized to taking drug or have surgery immediately, and to see if this drug makes a difference. And this works well in the Canadian system. It's a very difficult study, as you can imagine, in the United States, where Americans want to have their hernia repaired next week. They're not going to wait 6 weeks for a hernia repair. They're not going to wait 3 months for a radical prostatectomy. Where, unfortunately, the standard of care in Canada is that we wait a month or two or three before we have our surgery. So these type of treatments are done more in Canada than in the United States because it's more attractive to the Canadian system. But we may find that if this works, that you may go to your doctor and you may have a Gleason 5 or a Gleason 6 prostate cancer with a PSA of 5 or 6. We put you on this drug, and we find out that 80% of these patients, the prostate cancer goes away because we'll take it out in this group of patients. In the future, we may say, I'm going to treat you for 6 months, re-biopsy you, and if you don't have cancer, I'm not going to do a radical prostatectomy. So this is a very forward-thinking trial because it may prevent people from having cancer. The benefit for these patients, there isn't a large benefit. They still have to wait the 3 to 4 months to have their surgery. They're not going to have, when I say immediate prostatectomy, it's going to be just as quick as they would have had whether or not they were on the trial or not. The benefit is that if this drug works and prevents cancer, they may be one of the people whose cancer is eliminated by the drug. If this drug turns out to make cancer worse, they may be one of these people where the cancer is made worse, although we really don't think that's the case, and there's very little evidence to suggest that's the case. But in any drug treatment, you know, drugs have side effects, but these drugs are fairly straightforward. So this is a really exciting trial. Now, what about patients who have the disease, have had their treatment? And we call your treatment, when you've had your definitive treatment, you've gone to your doctor, you've had radiation, or you've had your prostatectomy, or if you decided on watchful waiting. About 30% of patients who've had treatment develop recurrent disease. And there are two drugs that are around now that are being tested in this population. One is called atrasentan, and it's by Abbott Pharmaceuticals, and it's a drug, it's an endothelin inhibitor. Suffice it to say that it's a drug that prevents new blood vessels from growing, and for a tumor to grow, it needs a blood supply, and it sends out chemicals to build bridges of blood vessels, and these drugs interfere with that chemical message. It was initially tested in men who had very, very bad disease, and was stopped because it didn't seem to have an effect. It had an effect, but not as much effect they want. So they've backed it up, and they're using it in men who have either after radical prostatectomy and other groups as well. But this is an ongoing trial in men whose PSAs come back after radical prostatectomy. And to get into this trial, you have to have a doubling time of less than a year. In other words, your PSA has to double every year or less to get into the trial. Because those of you who have PSAs who go from 0.1 to 0.3 next year to 0.5 the year after that, you're going to be dead in 25 years. And so you don't really need treatment. But those of you whose PSA go from 1 to 2.5 to 3.5, whose PSA is growing up, may benefit from this type of treatment. So this is instead of standard treatment, and standard treatment for you whose PSA has come back after radical prostatectomy is either radiation, and many men say, well, geez, you know, I had the surgery. I don't know if I want to have the side effects of radiation, or to watch it and do nothing, or to go back on hormones. And hormone therapy isn't the best treatment when it comes to side effects. There is another drug from another company that's different mechanism of action, that's, again, for the same population, but also they're looking at patients who've had radiation. We don't know if patients who recur after radiation recur at the same rate or the same reason for men who have had surgery. Because after you've had radiation, your PSA rarely goes to zero. If you've just had radiation by itself, it goes down to 0.6, 0.7, 0.5. If you've had hormones and radiation, it will often go down to zero. But if you have radiation, it'll come back up. If you've had radiation, it doesn't go to zero. So we don't know if that represents cancer that's still there or benign disease. So there's another drug that we're testing now for radiation failures. Now, When we say treat radical prostatectomy or radiation failures, you may not really be a failure. You're just a chemical failure. You know, just because you get a C+ on an exam, that doesn't mean you've failed. I mean, you may not be as good as someone who's gotten an A, but no one knows unless they look at your grades. So no one knows you failed unless they look at your PSA. You may be healthy and fine, have no problems, and we all get a little paranoid with our PSAs creeping up. So this is a nice area of research for companies, because there's so many of us that are sort of in the gray zone waiting for the other shoe to drop to go to the doctor and say, I know your PSA was 3 last time, it's 26 now. And that rarely ever happens, but we all worry about that. So there are two drug trials that are going on that are looking at this. To get into this trial, you need to have 3 PSAs successfully that are going up 2 weeks apart. Okay. And I'm sure many of you have had a PSA that's gone from 0.5 to 0.6 to 0.4 to 0.8 to 0.3. It tends to go up and down. So before you need to be concerned, you need to have 3 successive rises to get involved in these studies. Again, because these trials are early, there is a placebo. And I'm certain that I have a number of men in my practice that are having a great response to the placebo. So, and in a study like this, I don't know if you're getting the drug or not. Okay. So that's in. You've had your definitive treatment and you've failed. There's something to do while you're waiting for the other shoe to drop, if the other shoe's ever going to drop. What do you do if you've had your treatment, now you've had your hormones, if you read the data and you look at the effect of hormones, you realize that hormone therapy has an effect and it will prolong your life, but the prolongation is not that much. And some men, I mean, I remember my second or third year of practice, sitting with the guy who owns the local garage at the corner of my street, and telling Sven, you're going to be dead in 6 months because your PSA is about 50. It was acid phosphatase at the time, and your BUN and creatinine are going up. I'm just going to try something, try some hormones, but it's temporary, and the literature tells me that it's not going to prolong your life. He still fixes my car 20 years later. And what the literature says and what happens to you is it can be different, because the literature looks at specific groups of patients. But we do know that hormone therapy, the skinny on hormone therapy is it does very little to prolong your life expectancy, different than what it would have been without hormone therapy. Okay. But we do know that there's enough noise in the literature that says that nutrition, changing nutrition may make a difference. But the problem with nutrition is that we're dealing with men. And you tell a man you need to change your diet, you know, that means he doesn't go to Wendy's 4 times a week, he'll go 3 times a week. And his wife will get sick and tired of telling him he shouldn't be eating this and finally give up. And we found that while shortly after the diagnosis of cancer, men are the most motivated people in the world. But after a while, when 3 months later we realize we're not dead, we're back to Wendy's. Okay, so we do know that you need ongoing support for any significant dietary change. There are some men, God bless you, that can effectively change their diet and eat properly and exercise, but most men don't. So what we with Aventis, we decided to take men and give them nutritional advice, and take another half of men and give them a nutritionist who visited with them regularly, who was a surrogate partner who said, you're not eating properly, I know you're not eating properly, this is how you should eat, and hope that by driving this information into their brain a little bit further, that they'd actually change their diet. And we're looking to see if there's a difference, not in the way they end up, whether they live longer, if giving men nutritional support actually changes the way he eats. And interestingly enough, it looks as though it does make a difference. That men that are given diets who have a diagnosis of prostate cancer, you compare them to men that are given diets and a nutritionist who visits with them once a month, that group of men actually change their diet. And if the nutritional data is correct and that you live longer with vitamin E and selenium, we hope that those men that have nutritionists will live longer. And so then your doctor will be able to say, say to you, look, I'm not going to tell you about diet. You need to see a nutritionist, because that's the only way most men are going to make changes. And this is a study where the company has supported it by paying for all the dietitian. So we have a full-time dietitian who sees our patients, who those in study get nutritional. And if you don't want to be in the study, you can pay the nutritionist to bug you for a year as well. And it works quite nicely. Okay. And we're just trying to see if the effect of nutritional support makes the nutritional support stick. Okay. Now, there's been some recent information about bones and prostate cancer. I'm sure you're all aware of this. And I did you have Fred Saad come out and speak to the group? Was he a guy from Montreal? Or you probably had someone speak to you, or not. I'm sure your organizer will have someone soon. What we've been doing for years with men with prostate cancer is we've been giving them these hormone concoctions and making their bones brittle. And as those of you that have prostate cancer or have friends, we know that the battle for prostate cancer is now fought in the bones. Since men, as I said earlier in the talk, men die differently now from prostate cancer. They used to die from local disease with their kidneys being blocked, with a catheter and bleeding. It was horrible. Now most men die with some bony metastases because we do a very good job of controlling the prostate cancer in the prostate. We let it spread to the bones. And when your doctor gives you Lupron or Zoladex, they're all the same. He takes away your hormones and he makes your bones deteriorate over the course of time when you're taking it. Because as we know that in women who go through the change of life, their risk of hip fracture goes up tremendously because of lack of hormones and bone deterioration. We do the same thing when we put you on a hormone agent. We turn you into, give you the same risk as women when it comes to hip fracture. And if you fracture your hip and have prostate cancer, there's a 25% chance you're not going to recover from the hip fracture. You will die. So we've realized that we've done a good job in getting your PSA to zero, but we've done a very bad job of keeping your bones safe. And we wonder, maybe the reason prostate cancer goes to the bones in our patients and since is because we don't prepare the bones properly and we allow the cancer to go to the bones. That's part of it. It'll still go to the bones whether or not we give you hormone therapy. So there was a recent trial that looked at Zometa, and Zometa is a drug for osteoporosis. Much like there's a number of oral drugs that your wives or maybe some of you take already for osteoporosis, but Zometa was an intravenous drug. It's a bisphosphonate. It's a mineral that goes into your bones. And the trial showed that there was 25% less complications from bones in men who took this drug who had prostate cancer, and there may have even been a survival advantage. So they may live 5 or 6 months longer. Now, you might say, big deal, 5 or 6 months. But once you have bony metastases and your drug, and the doctor says, I can't give you any more hormones because your PSA is still rising, and you start to develop pain in your bones, your life expectancy is somewhat limited. And 5 or 6 months can be a significant improvement in your life expectancy, and it may even be longer than that. But more importantly, if he can prevent you from having your vertebrae collapse or breaking a hip, he may make the last year or two of your life much more comfortable. That's the one extreme. But what we're doing now, and we've been able to convince the two companies who sell these drugs, well, maybe if we start the drug earlier, even before the cancer gets to the bones, and we give it to you when we know we're going to start making your bones weak, we'll give it to you right up front, maybe we can keep your bone density good enough that the cancer will less likely go to your bones, and it may delay the disease completely. So at least when your doctor gives you Lupron or Zoladex or Superfact, he should say you should take vitamin D and calcium. That's the least he should be telling you now. If you're not, you should go back and speak to him. Maybe the best he should be doing is giving you a drug for osteoporosis as well to prevent. And so this study is aimed at seeing if it makes a difference, and we know that it probably does because the Americans have done a similar study. So if we can keep your bones in shape, maybe we can do another step in making men with prostate cancer die from something else, which would be natural causes. Wouldn't that be nice? You know. So this is a study where men receive an intravenous infusion once a month, four times a year while they're getting their hormone therapy. The side effects of the drug are fairly minimal. And the upside is that they may keep their bones a lot stronger. The downside is half the men get nothing. But that is presently the standard of care right now. So right now the Zometa is really only indicated for those of you, and I hope there's no one here, who have rising PSAs who've already had hormone therapy. That drug, you should be given that drug if your PSA is going up despite having been on Lupron, Zoladex, and Superfact. You notice I say all three drugs every time because I don't want anyone's being recorded, any of the companies to think that I favor one. They're all the same drug. Okay. So we're now moving into a new area where we're not only thinking about the prostate cancer, we're thinking about the complications from prostate cancer, and many, many men who are on these agents develop hip fractures and spinal cord fractures, and they're very painful and difficult to treat. So we're looking ahead to try to prevent that. I talked about atrasentan. Not only is it being used in men after radical prostatectomy, it's now being used in men who would be the same group of men who would be candidates for Zometa, In other words, their PSA is going up. They've had all their treatment, and they're looking at having standard chemotherapy. The doctor's saying, well, I can give you some prednisone or some other drugs. That you may lose your hair. You may be in hospital. This is a non-hormonal agent that's being used before chemotherapy, and this drug is being introduced. So to summarize before we get to questions, and I'm sure you want a break. You've been listening to me for almost an hour. There's a lot of research going on in prostate cancer, and we'll see a lot more. There's a big move in pre-malignant disease. In other words, you're going to read more about drugs that prevent prostate cancer, and on the other hand, you hear that these drugs, by preventing prostate cancer in a quarter, they make another 25% of men have a higher grade of prostate cancer. I think the way that's going to settle is that we're going to have some drugs that will prevent cancer in about 25% of patients who we know are going to get cancer. Okay, there is a increased effort to try to do a better job of local control, and I think in the future your doctor will say you can have seeds and external beam radiation and hormones, or you can have surgery and hormones or these new drugs. I think we're going to see more combined therapy, because none of us really believe that radiation or surgery alone is the answer to most people, because cancer is a systemic disease. When you have prostate cancer, if I measure your blood while you have cancer, there's cancer cells in your blood. The same if you have breast cancer or colon cancer. But your body takes care of it. It's when your body fails that you develop recurrent disease. So a surgeon is naive to think that if we cut it out, in most cases, we can cure the disease, because we're unable to do it in about a third of patients. There are good treatments now that are non-hormonal, that aren't going to affect your sex life and your bones after your first treatment. And there are good treatments that are, again, non-hormonal for localized disease. And most of the industry now is looking at drugs that are going to be used before or after you've had your hormonal treatment, because of the side effects of hormonal treatment. Now, you know, when I first started practice, we didn't have Zoladex or Superfactor or Lucon. We just had a knife and castration, which is probably the cheapest and best way to remove your hormones, despite the fact that these agents are a multi-million dollar industry. They have side effects, but once we remove your testicles, we can't give you the testosterone back. And there may be, as you know, if any of you are on intermittent therapy, that's a new mindset that we put you on hormones for a while and we take you off, then put you back on, take you off. And so we're trying to change the way we treat patients with these newer agents. Okay. So I guess in summary, the trials are there to advance our knowledge, but also to help you. I think those of you that are involved in clinical trials get the perception that you get a bit of value added to your care. We're not supposed to treat you any differently. You're not supposed to get any better treatment, but you do have access to a nurse, and those of you who go to physicians who have nurses realize that the most important person in the office is the receptionist, number one, the nurse, number two, and the doctor's number three. You know, okay? So if you can get the ear of the nurse, you got the ear of the doctor, and then some. And she'll get you an appointment tomorrow if you need it. So you do get a little bit of better access to your doctors, but you should get the same care. And as physicians, if your physician is involved in clinical trials, that means he cares enough about the disease to hire a nurse, to go to meetings and learn about the disease, and to try new treatments, because he's not getting paid a lot to do it. He gets his time reimbursed, but not to the he's not you're not going to get rich doing clinical trials unless you find gold in your patients, which you're not. Okay, right. So what questions do we need to be answered? We still need to decide who needs treatment, because this watchful waiting thing hasn't been decided. Lori Klotz at Sunnybrook has done an excellent job of trying to identify who the patients are, and I mean, he's probably the world expert on who should be treated and who shouldn't be treated, because not everybody who has prostate cancer needs treatment. We still don't know what the best treatment is for localized disease. I'm a surgeon. It's surgery, but I'm biased. Okay. We don't know who to use combination therapy on, when to use hormones, or when to start chemotherapy. So these questions all need to be answered through prospective, double-blind, randomized clinical trials, and who most of you will not participate in because you probably already have prostate cancer. And I guess what we would say is that everything I know about prostate cancer, I've learned from my patients over the years, and I continue to learn more. Any questions? Yes.
My question is, if the patients with the localized disease confined, they have the same cure with the radiation and surgery either side, or it is big difference between each other?
The question is if you have localized disease, is it the same cure at radiation as surgery?
Which is confined, the localized disease?
I don't know. And I don't think anybody knows. We know that if you take the same patient, and you can't compare one patient with another, there are some patients that where the two treatments are the same. And in other words, you can compare whether me or you would do better with one treatment, but in your case, there are some predictors that would tell us what treatment is better, but we won't know which treatment is better until we look 15 years ahead in the future. For example, there are risks of both therapies, and if you're 65 years old and have had bypass surgery and are still smoking a half a pack a day, I can tell you that probably radiation is preferable to surgery because the risks of surgery make radiation much more attractive. Which treatment is going to cure the cancer? It's not as important in curing the cancer as it is in curing the patient and keeping the patient alive to live a reasonable quality of life. So when you make these treatment decisions, it's not always based on what's going to cure the cancer. It's what's going to give you the best quality of life for whatever life you have. So I can't answer your question, and that's where your urologist comes in, looks at you as a whole person and says, I know you. You'll go crazy if you have surgery. It's not going to work because you hate catheters and you've had blood clots before. Radiation is perfect for you. So that's where your doctor needs to.
And also in the way of the life expectancy.
Well, it depends. How much longer are you going to live? Do you know?
It depends if you are below 60.
I don't know. I mean, funny. I ask my patients, how much longer are you going to live? And, you know, every guy in my office is going to live to 95.
We don't know.
We don't know. So you look at, if your parents, I ask them first, is your father still alive? And if his father's still alive and he's in my office with prostate cancer, then I don't have to worry about his life expectancy. So it really depends on your other risk factors. So I can't answer that. The two treatments appear to be in comparable patients who are both appropriate for treatment. The two treatments are very close, and it's the price you pay that's different. You pay a different price for surgery than you do for radiation, and it depends on your personal purse what price you want to pay. Some men would say, there's just no way I could ever risk being incontinent. It would be the worst thing that ever happened to me. Then radiation is the way to go. Other men who go to Vegas twice a year like a little bit of gambling, they want that 70% chance they'd be cured and not do, maybe then radical prostatectomy is the way to go.
But according to the
literature, there have been no trials, and that's why the SPEAR trial is so different. There have been no trials that have taken the decision away from you and said, okay, you're appropriate for radiation and surgery. I'm going to decide what treatment you have based on a coin toss. That trial needs to be done, and that's probably will never be done. That's why the SPEAR trial is such a good trial where patients actually have to give the decision to the doctor, and we'll know in 15 years. I can ask you a question just before I retire 15 years from now.
But if we go by example, for 10, 15 years, patients which they did radiation and surgery, which of them is longer?
I can't answer that question. They both do the same.
The same thing.
Yeah, I can't answer that. I wish I could.
Thank you.
There and then in the back.
After the trials are finished, can the volunteers find out whether they were on a placebo or a drug?
Not always. In some trials, they can. Most trials, the volunteers, and that's understood before the trial is going, most trials, the patient will never know if they're on drug. Only if it's for their benefit. They don't know if they've been on drug or not. So it's a guess. I have a lot of patients that have been on prostate shrinkers who to this date, they still don't know whether they're on the drug or not after the trial's over.
Question from the back?
No, anything in the back? Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, sorry.
Oh. And one last thing. If you have questions or you have you want to know some information about clinical trials, my website's Dr. Casey at Mayo Health. I'm not looking for volunteers. I can give you information. Dr. Casey at MayoHealth.com. Or just ask your organizer and they'll get access to me. And I can tell you if there's people in your neighborhood that are involved. Thanks again.
Thank you.